If you research ancient Egyptian mysteries for any length of time, one of the most enigmatic things you're going to come across is the presence of tobacco and cocaine in mummies that predate Columbian contact with the New World by thousands of years. And that's where those drugs come from, is the New World. In 1992, German forensic toxicologist Svetlana Balabanova, I'm exactly perfectly pronouncing her name right, we'll call her Svetlana, she did some studies and reported her findings, and it seems that the mummies that she was studying liked to party. They had traces of cocaine and tobacco and hashish in their hair, in their bodies, in their skin, in their stomachs. And at any rate, of course, this created quite a debate, and it still rages to this day. And some might even say there's a cover-up involved. So sit down for a minute and let's talk about the cocaine mummies. Hi, my name is Dan, and welcome to Dedunking. Now, Svetlana had 9 mummies that she studied from the Munich Museum, and of those 9, all 9 tested positive for cocaine. And now, of course, this created quite a bit of a stir because there was no cocaine in Egypt, according to mainstream history, way back when these mummies were supposed to have existed. As such, the initial criticism is, this is impossible, you know, the old chestnut that assumes that we know everything already, or at least enough to dismiss hard data in favor of idealism. But others did look into her findings. You know, as a forensic toxicologist, Svetlana was familiar with the practice of searching for chemicals in humans, often in deceased humans. Her methods were laid out plainly. She washed the hair, teeth, bone, and flesh with distilled water, and then pulverized the samples individually with a steel ball to minimize contamination. Then she used chemical extraction processes to isolate the drugs from the rest of the sample. You know, the kind of thing that Walter White excelled at, but Richard Pryor, not so much. Now remember that the samples were washed with water because this will come up again. And after the samples were tested, her findings were astonishing to most. Cocaine, nicotine, and THC were all found in the samples taken. Considerably more THC was found everywhere except in the stomachs. And THC is, I should let you know in case you're Amish, the active ingredient in marijuana. Now there are a couple possible explanations for the increased concentration. One is that THC has a much longer lifespan in the human body than cocaine or nicotine. The other is that marijuana was not unknown in the old world. Now, how I know about the length of time that one drug stays in the system as opposed to another one is purely from doing research and has nothing to do with personal experience. Omelette's Honor. At any rate, the reefers aren't really a big deal. Think about this like your local bar scene. It's the cocaine we're going to be poking our noses into. The nicotine, of course, for the same reason. Where did it all come from? Now, the first thing to look into is the samples. Where were they from, and how sure are we of their past? What's called provenance, as most of you would know. Now, the first mummy to be looked into is a famous one. It's a 21st dynasty priestess named Henetui, the priestess. Whatever those words are that I can't pronounce translates to Mistress of the Two Lands, and she lived about 3,000 years ago. Now, she was of high status, and in her role, she performed rituals and chants that were highly venerated. She died at about 21 years of age, and her body wasn't rediscovered until the early 19th century. Now, this was the early days of archaeology, so records are scant. Apparently, writing things down was too complicated for academics back in those days, so we don't really know where it was found or a lot of things about it, but we do know that it was of high status based on the inscriptions inside of the sarcophagus. An explorer named Franz Wilhelm Sieber purchased the mummy in 1818 and sold it to the Bavarian Academy of Sciences in 1820. Several other objects were also in this collection, 230 in total. The point here is this mummy, the one that's the most famous of the 9 now and in her lifetime, has about as good a provenance as we can expect from anything back in the early 1800s. The other 8 skeletons tested, well, one skeleton and 7 heads, had similarly sketchy provenance. Now, this is an issue to a degree. We really do not know where these mummies came from exactly besides Egypt. The dating of these action figures was based on whatever accessories they came with, if you follow my metaphor. In other words, they knew how old Henetui was because of her sarcophagi, and the other remains offered similar means of dating. but where they came from and who held them from the time they were taken from the ground until they were sold to Munich in 1820 is unknown. So the first place to look for possible sources of contamination is the early 19th century. How possible is it that somebody accidentally spilled a little cocaine on a mummy around the 1820s? Well, the answer is not likely. Until it was chemically purified into the cocaine we all know and love the smell of today, which happened in 1855, the popularity of coca wasn't very high. People who lived where it grew chewed coca leaves, which is the source of cocaine, and the Spaniard conquerors who enslaved the locals outlawed this. Then they allowed the natives to begin chewing it again, and it was common to see natives chewing coca leaves in silver mines in South America all the way up until the 1600s. But the active drug would diminish in long voyages overseas, and it took quite a bit to get the stimulating effects, so it really wasn't popular in the West until they isolated cocaine, which, funnily enough, started things like Coca-Cola and then created a popularity of people using just the leaves. It kind of came full circle then. Pope Leo XIII praised a drink known as Vin Mariani, which was wine with coca leaves in it. Don't pick on me because I can pronounce the drug words right and nothing else. I ain't hearing it. It became known as a wonder drug, and this lasted for a long time, up until the 1920s when the Prohibition movement began to gain steam. So without cracking out on the details of the history of cocaine, I can tell you that it is highly unlikely that any was spilled onto these mummies between 1810 and 1820. Get it? Highly unlikely? So we can rule out contamination from those days, but what about contamination since then? As cocaine was incredibly popular and legal for a time, it being used around the mummies and then spilled on them like at some degenerate island party, it really isn't out of the question. This goes all the way back to at least to the 60s and 70s. Hell, it was my initial reaction when me and Joe Rogan were talking about it.
What was the evidence of cocaine in mummies? Was that bullshit?
I'm not sure about that. It's one of the things that every time I look into it, the data's kind of threadbare, and as a skeptical guy and a guy who's had his share of time in bars and bathrooms, I have a much stronger feeling that there was some anthropologist in the 70s who was just doing a fucking bump. I'm sorry. That's way – smoking a cigarette and doing a bump on the sarcophagus is way more likely than – not just to me. But
do you remember how Svetlana prepared the samples? She washed them with distilled water. Now, this modern stuff that they started smoking back in the 80s, that oil – you're not going to clean that off without using alcohol. But the stuff that they did in the 60s and 70s and early 80s, you know, the kind of stuff that smells good, the kind of stuff that Mike Myers got all into in Studio 54, the snow on the mountains, that stuff, that's water-soluble as hell. Ask anybody who's tried to cut up a line on a dewy, misty morning just how bad water will mess with your cocaine. Now, this is something that I don't know personally. Again, this is the kind of thing I had to ask around about and do a lot of research in order to figure this out. But I've talked to a lot of people that, and this is what they said. And the same thing actually goes for tobacco. You know, tobacco oil, if you hit it with water, it's just going to rinse it right off of this thing. Now, if it's a large amount of tobacco oil that's isolated and rubbed in, that's different, which we will potentially discuss. So with cocaine, exterior contamination is basically out. And we're stuck facing the positive results of the tests and their implications, right? Not so fast, young Padawan. Skeptics bring up a number of complaints, and some of those are actually worth considering. Now, some of those are just grasping at straws. I'm working on a video response to Dr. David Miano of World of Antiquity. Now, as you can see, I'm not home yet. I'm still in Arizona, so the response to Dr. Miano won't be coming out right away. When it does, I'll post a link in my post tabs to my second channel and all that jazz. But I think what's really important to mention here is, well, next time I get in trouble with the law, I'm going to hire Miano as my attorney. The way that he is trying to just massage away, explain away all these positive tests is Saul Goodman would be proud. We'll just say that. One of the immediate complaints is the provenance is worrisome and that exterior contamination is a viable alternative to drugs being present in the mummies from use. Now, since I've already addressed this, I really only mention it because it shows a lack of research on the part of these people. This is an issue. Where there's smoke, there's fire, as they say, and in this case, the smoke is using faulty arguments, and the fire is an intense desire to debunk this. Now, thanks to their biases in this case, I can't trust them any more than I would trust somebody that would just immediately knee-jerk and say, oh, of course the cocaine was found in the Egyptian mummies. We know there was cross-continental contact back in those days. Unfortunately, thanks to these biases, we kind of have to just evaluate these things ourselves. So here we are. And there is one big claim that gets thrown around by all the skeptics. Replicability is impossible. And this is also an issue for the believers. The fact is that other researchers, all other researchers, have been denied access to these mummies for further chemical testing since those tests were performed. In other words, in order to replicate their findings, they had to test other mummies. And I probably don't need to explain to you the problem there. If I'm hanging out with you and you got a bunch of drugs in your system because I don't do anything like that, that doesn't mean that I have a bunch of drugs in my system, right? And the skeptics aren't the only ones complaining about this. In all honesty, it seems like any time there's an amazing discovery or an amazing claim, a follow-up is hindered. Whether it's the void in the Great Pyramid, the 90% of Göbekli Tepe that remains unexcavated, the elongated skulls with the strangest measurements, or the mummies that have cocaine in them, it seems like the coolest stuff is always the things we're not allowed to follow up on. Is that really the case, though? The fact is, these destructive tests, as they are known, are just that. They're destructive. Again, they smashed the samples into powder, remember? So the human remains, well, there is a finite amount of human remains, and the rich people have to have some mummies to chew on, so they don't want to just get rid of all the pieces of these things. And this isn't a roadblock unique to these mummies. But what is strange was the fact that she was allowed to continue her tests on other mummies around the world, but attempts to replicate her findings would only be done on other mummies. The Munich Nine, as the first nine mummies she tested became known, were never again tested for employment. I mean, for drugs. Not really sure why I said employment there, but anyway, the testing on many of the other mummies was highly publicized. The Manchester Museum tests were filmed and aired on TV, in which six tissue samples from the, you guessed it, Manchester Museum, were tested by Svetlana and her team. No cocaine was found, but there was nicotine in about half the samples. And this was followed by tests on Nubian mummies, 134 or so of them. The number isn't specific because some parts fell off the mummies, so they can't say with certainty how many exactly were tested. However, similar to her first follow-up study, about a third of these mummies tested positive for cocaine and nicotine and THC. And if they were to test, probably alcohol too. That is a pretty popular combination, right? And anyway, Svetlana also did some tests in the Americas. In 1992, she published the results of two Peruvian mummies, one adult female and one infant. Now, the woman had a significant amount of cocaine in her system, enough she wasn't going to be able to hide it from her peers. A small fraction of that amount was found in the infant, suggesting that the infant got it through breast milk or maybe the placenta. I guess drugs and pregnancy aren't exactly a new problem. I mean, look at this kid's face. Now, the amount found in the female mummy was much higher than that found in Egypt. The Munich 9, those nine Egyptian mummies, had between 24 and 441 nanograms per gram, while the adult woman from Peru had 1,700 nanograms per gram. Now, this massive disparity has been used to question the findings, but this is clearly naive. Peru is where the drug came from. Egypt was where the drug was shipped to. The dealer tends to have a larger supply than their customer. And then you got the baby with a tiny fraction of the amount of its mother, looking again like breast milk or from through the placenta. Again, this all adds up. If you look at it, it's through the lens of like logic, that actually makes a ton of sense. If we found the same amount of cocaine in the Egyptian mummies as we did in the Peruvian ones, that wouldn't make any sense. They don't have to ship it over. So I bet it was worth a whole lot more in Egypt than it was in Peru. I wonder if it's worth more in Florida than it is in Sinaloa. I'm not sure, but some of you out there could probably tell me. And now more tests have been done, some on Chinese mummies, more with European mummies, other African and New World mummies, mostly looking for tobacco. But like any good barfly, I'm interested in the cocaine. But there's a serious reason for that. It's not just a joke. This is the least likely drug to be accidentally spilt on the mummies. I mean, it's feasible that some of the mummies were exposed to cocaine powder between 1855 and, say, 1993. But as I mentioned earlier, the water would remove all traces of powder cocaine. And in many cases, Svetlana used alcohol also as a cleaning agent. So cocaine would have completely been washed off, which makes it worth fixating on. Especially when you consider that tobacco oil was sometimes used as an insect repellent in the 1800s, is the kind of thing they may have rubbed mummies down with or sprayed them down with. So that becomes less likely, I guess, a less robust piece of evidence. But that cocaine, boy, just stands on its own 2 feet now, don't it? Or keep you standing on your own 2 feet. So at the end of the day, there's a lot more than a white trash reason to look for that pile of powder. And we have a very compelling picture for cross-Atlantic contact millennia before it is currently accepted to have occurred. And of course, this has created so much opposition that it's hard to find good data on the topic. Again, I'll be responding to David Miano from World of Antiquity because he tried to make this like comprehensive thing on it. But that guy talking about cocaine is like me talking about being an altar boy. Zero experience. Not that I know anything about cocaine. Again, that's going to go up on my second channel here shortly, probably a week or so, and I'll make sure and post the link to that in the post section of this channel. But for now, I'm going to cover the most common criticisms that he brings up, and number one is contamination. As I've already said, you can really rule that out. All you have to do is know anything about this stuff and read how Svetlana did her work. But that doesn't stop people from using this as a stick to just beat this idea right off the table. Another common complaint is people accuse Svetlana of just straight up falsifying the reports, which, I mean, I suppose it's possible, but there's a problem. Since they don't allow us to retest the 9 crackhead mummies, but some of the tobacco ones have been retested and found to contain tobacco, it's a pretty bold accusation for them to just say, hey, Svetlana was lying. That kind of turns the whole apple cart on its head. Why should I trust you if I can't trust the other scientists? What, you're somehow better than them? Did you bring data to bear, or are you just kicking the tires of her argument without actually bringing data? Because at that point, you do realize you're basically saying, we're liars. I mean, enough of us are liars that don't even need data to call out one of our own as a liar. That's kind of bad optics. Not sure if you're a science communicator, but if you are, Dr. David Miano, probably a bad idea to go down that road. Another criticism is maybe she just screwed up, and that seems very unlikely, given the numerous different places and mummies she pulled the samples from. Unless Svetlana herself has got some ether she's mixing with that stuff between tests, doesn't really make a lot of sense to me. Instead, it tells me the lengths that some are willing to go through just to debunk her work. Accusing her of not knowing how to do her job right is, well, again, to return to my last point, why should we trust anybody in your community if you guys highly hold up Svetlana at one point, but as soon as she says something you don't like, she's heavily criticized? Oh yeah, by the way, she was a highly regarded forensic toxicologist, not just some rando that does it in their spare time or a lab tech. The attacks against Svetlana have been outright brutal at times. She's been accused of being a conspiracy theorist, for being hell-bent on rewriting history, for being unscientific and outright lying. And this tells us so much more than just the data does. It shows the environment, the gauntlet, that data that challenges old paradigms must navigate. A great, succinct quote can be found from Egyptologist John Baines. The idea that the Egyptians should have traveled to America is overall absurd, and I don't know anyone who spends time doing research in these areas because they're not perceived to be areas that have any real meaning for the subjects. But a much wordier and insulting statement was made by ethnobiologist Giorgio Sammarini. One last question I will try to answer is, who is Balabanova really? What was behind the appearance of a normal researcher? She is undoubtedly a researcher who has done considerable damage. For example, she humiliated Egyptologists and their scientific discipline in front of the whole world. We have seen how the key text for understanding Balabanova's thought and character is her 1997 book on tobacco. In this book, referring to the opposition from the scientific world in accepting these as the existence of tobacco and corn originating in the old world, Balabanova repeatedly quoted the phrase, "What cannot, must not be," thus alluding to a hypothetical intentional will on the part of official science to hide inconvenient truths. Behind this sentence seems to hide the key to interpreting the work of this Bulgarian researcher. A conspiracy theorist character seems to be at the core. A certain degree of mythnomania should not be excluded from a character analysis. Balabanova should be considered a proto-conspiracy theorist. The main purpose of the conspiracy theorist, understood as a contemporary character figure, is to contradict the officially recognized interpretive models, whether in history, science, political events, etc., on the basis of the firm belief in the existence of plots or conspiracies that act in deference of the interpretive status quo. And while there are other criticisms of her work out there, several of them in fact, they all seem to circle back to the same loaded idea that Svetlana is a conspiracy theorist. And that idea is so loaded, it's more loaded than those mummies were. I mean, we've got a lot of different people saying a lot of crazy stuff, but I guess one of the best examples would come from that YouTuber, Dr. David Miano.
Here's how Balabanova describes the reaction to her findings.
I got a pile of letters that were almost threatening, insulting letters, saying that all this was nonsense, that I was fantasizing, that it was quite impossible, because it was proven that before Columbus these plants were not found anywhere in the world apart from America.
These kinds of stories are red meat for alternative history proponents because they like to believe that good science very often can't move forward because of interference by the powers that be, who don't want history to be changed. I've not seen these letters that Balabanova describes as almost threatening, and I don't know who wrote them, or even if they come from higher-ups. But it does not surprise me that people would be incredulous about her conclusions, and that they would think she made a mistake.
Again, I'll be addressing his entire video on that very soon. I'm still here in Sedona, Arizona. By the time you see this, I will probably be either just about to leave or back in Spokane, Washington. I want to thank you all very much for supporting the channel and for supporting me and this kind of craziness where I get to travel around and babble at people and shake hands and meet folk. I got to handle the first crystal skull that was put on Ancient Aliens. I got to check out a sweat lodge that's got a bunch of crystals involved that was made by an actual electrician who went out of his way to make sure that piezoelectricity is incorporated in this, and he took care to accurately do it so it will work. Smart guy, smart stuff. He doesn't poke himself in the eye either when he talks. And hopefully here in the near future, I'll have dates for you for Austin, Texas, and we're going to be doing the Quest for Ancient Civilization conference there in a much larger venue with some bigger guests than me even. And I don't just mean guys that are fatter. Well, though that's not too difficult. I'm just a little guy. But anyway, thanks so much for watching. I hope to see you next time. And please don't go out and try to play Egyptian mummies tonight, okay? You just make it so much more expensive for the rest of us when we're looking to play Egyptian mummies. Have a good day.